This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who we can call heroes because they have done things for the sake of our freedom that many of us can't even imagine going through. That is certainly going to be the case today as we listen to a story of one of America's ex-prisoners of war. But the idea behind the show is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're always entertained, and oftentimes inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I have the privilege of introducing you today to 92-year-old Ray Maloney. I'm catching up with him down in Bonita Springs, Florida. Maybe you see him up in the Northeast. He's one of those snowbirds on the East Coast. But many years ago, he was wondering if he'd ever make it back to the East Coast, a prisoner, a guest of the Gestapo overseas during World War II. We'll get to that, but let's start early, Ray. Growing up in Long Island, New York. See how I said that? Did I get that right?
You got that right.
All right.
Accent on the G.
That's right. Yeah. The second word starts with a G, I think.
Yeah, right.
So you grew up there. What was life like there in the 1930s and early 40s?
Well, my father worked as a customs officer in New York Harbor. And so during the Depression, he worked all the time. Fortunately, you know, we had food on the table, but we were never could be called well off or anything of that sort. We lived in 31st Street in Brooklyn, just off 4th Avenue. My brother came 10 years after I was born, and my mother was English, and she was a war bride from World War I.
Wow.
My father had fought in France and was wounded, shot through the chest and then gassed, mustard gas attack, and was convalescing in England in a British hospital and got friends with a British soldier in the next bed. And when they were convalescing and had a little time to themselves, they went downtown looking for some action, of course, and picked up two sisters. And my father married one of them, and this other fellow, Jack Calaver, he married the other one.
How about that?
So they split these two. And so my mother came from England. She was English then, of course. And we lived in Brooklyn. That's where I was born and grew up until, I guess I was about 10 or 12, and then we moved out to Long Island, St. Albans, and went to high school there. Started work on a bank in Times Square, 1941, I guess it was.
When you talk about your father marrying your mother, a war bride, it strikes me, you would have never been born if your dad didn't get wounded in World War I.
That's true. That's right. It would have been somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah. I always tell those stories about World War II veterans, but this in this case, it's your dad who was wounded and gassed in World War I, and
that's
how he meets your mom. So, okay, so you're in Long Island. You're working at a bank in 1941.
Yeah, I worked for about better part of a year, and then the war started, you know, December 41.
What do you remember about that day, December 7th? How'd you find out?
I think it was a Sunday, of course.
Yeah.
I was with another couple of friends of mine, and we were sitting in a car listening to the news on the radio, and we heard about the attack, you know, on Pearl Harbor. And, you know, everybody, you know, it changed everybody's lives at that point. I was always interested in the sea because I grew up on Long Island. I used to sail and boat and fish. My father was a great fisherman. And so I tried the Navy Air Corps, and they said I had a heart murmur. And I was totally crushed. And some other friends of mine said, we're going to go down and try the Army Air Corps. So they said, come along. So I said, all right. So I went down early in the morning to Grand Central Station, which is where they had their recruiting thing that day. And by about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I was standing there. I promised to, you know, defend the Constitution. So I was in the Army, and they never said a peep about a heart murmur. And that's the last they ever heard of it.
Uh-huh.
So if I had one, the Army didn't care. So I went in and enlisted in, I think it was November or December of 42. And I started my flight training in January of 43 and got my wings in February of 44. And then after you've graduated, you know, you get a commission and your wings. Now you have to go to fighter training. And I was sent to Harris Neck, Georgia, to fly P-40s, you know, the ones that the Flying Tigers used to fly.
Yeah, General Chenault had them
over there.
Right,
yeah, well, I that was the first fighter I flew. And, in fact, it was the hardest fighter that I ever flown. It had a lot of things you had to do, six switches to fire the guns, and, you know, it just was a very complicated thing.
Let me ask you, I've talked to a lot of guys who got into the Air Corps. And everyone I've ever talked to who enlisted in the Air Corps did so because he wanted to be a pilot. A lot of them didn't end up being pilots. They ended up bombardiers, navigators, whatever.
Yeah.
I imagine along the way of your training, there were probably some things that you faced that were pretty tough to overcome. What was the most challenging part of your training or that journey to become a pilot to get those wings?
It was the very first, you go through a pre-flight at Maxwell Field first.
Uh-huh.
And then you for flight training, you go to primary, basic, and then finally advanced. And in primary, it was at Bennettsville, South Carolina, and I had a rebel instructor, and we didn't have electrical phone connection between front cockpit and the back. It was a Stearman. I don't know if you know the Stearman biplane, you know, with open cockpits.
Saw one a couple weeks ago. Touched the wing. Yeah,
that's a great little airplane. Yeah. Well, anyway, my instructor was a rebel from the South, and I couldn't understand him. You know, he had such a bad accent. And as I say, we didn't have electrical, radio connection. They had a little tube that he shouted through, and, you know, I would hear him shouting, and I wouldn't understand what it was. And I think I had about three or four flights with him, and he had other students. It was about four or five of us per instructor. And he mentioned to the other students in his little group, he said, "What's the matter with Maloney? He doesn't do what I tell him to do." So he says he can't understand. He's got no feel. So and they said, "Well, we don't know, but we'll ask him." And so I had a conversation one night with him, with my friends, and they spelled it out. They said that you got to listen to him. You know, tell him to talk a little slower. But they told the instructor that yes, he wants to be a pilot. He wants to be a fighter pilot, and all the rest of it. So they went through the little takeoff procedures where you have to fly out and then 45-degree turn right and out of the traffic padding and then climb out, you know, all this kind of protocols that you have to go through. When I heard that, I said, "Is that all he was asking about? Just to take off, go to 800 feet, make a 45 and climb?" He says, "Yeah." So the next day, I got in it and with the instructor in the back, and I did what I found. And he came down and he said, "What's happened? What have you done?" And I said, "I can understand what it was you wanted. I couldn't understand." So from that point on, he calmed down, talked slower, and in 7.5 hours, I soloed. You know, so I was right with the class then, and then I had no trouble getting through flight school at all. Yeah.
The Yankee and the Rebel needed a translator
somewhere in between, huh? That's all it was. I couldn't understand him. And the payoff was, remember, his name was John Paul Jones.
How about that?
Yeah, yeah. John Paul Jones.
And it's too bad you didn't know that, you know, 50 years later you'd be sailing the Bounty. Otherwise, you could have traded some naval stories.
That's true.
We'll get to that. You were talking about the P-40, and I think I interrupted you to ask about training. But what was it that was so challenging about the P-40?
Well, it's the first fighter that you get to fly.
Yep.
And you're used to, you know, what training planes are, and they're good aircraft and so forth. AT-6 was the one that was our advanced trainer. But you get in a fighter, and it's a whole new world because now you have an aircraft that's mean and built for performance and nothing else, you know. And the joke of it was that on your first flight that you take in the P-40, you don't get your head out of the cockpit till the airplane's at 4,000 feet and going, you know. It's a whole way awakening for you, you know. You got to now catch up because the airplane is, even that one, by, you know, training plane standards, was so fast that you're going to have to wake up and get ahead of this thing or it's going to kill you.
Yeah.
You know, so that becomes a challenge right there. You've got to master it. or you won't be around, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's something that I think most people don't realize, how many Americans lost their lives in the States during World War II, just training
accidents
in these planes that were really brand new in a lot of ways.
That's right, yeah.
But fortunately, you weren't among that number. And fortunately, there was a special someone in your life that you decided to take a certain step with before you headed overseas, huh?
Yeah, well, I knew Christina. She was in high school when I met her, and I had just graduated. I was working at that bank in Times Square. And we started to date, and I didn't even have a car then. I had to take a bus to get over to, you know, and I'd get back at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, from having a date with her. I was, as I say, a poor Irish kid from Brooklyn, you know, just going through the motions of living.
And what made you decide to ask her to marry you before you went over? Because a lot of guys said, you know, let me make sure I get back from this before we take a step like that.
Well, you know, I probably wasn't thinking right, but, you know, you have a lot of the hormones going, and kind of off the cuff, you think, oh, well, if I'm going over to the war, I'm probably going to get killed, so I might as well enjoy myself before I go, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I did love her, and she loved me, and I didn't want her to get away, you know?
Yeah.
And I thought, if I go over there, you know, there's a lot of guys that won't be there, and she'll be dating, so I asked her to marry me before I went, and she said fine. So we did.
Well, I guess 70 years later, you could say that was a wise decision.
Yeah, I think it's lasting. Yeah, it's going to last.
When did you head overseas, and what do you remember thinking about that? That now, after all this training, you're going to get a chance to go over there and do something about this enemy.
We went over on an army transport, and in those days, most ships that were going to Europe would go in a convoy. But for some reason, our troop transport was a fast ship. It was called the Richardson, I think, the USS Richardson. And as I say, it was an army transport. And it headed straight for Gibraltar. One day out of Gibraltar, we picked up a British destroyer to escort us. And we went through, you know, the straits there at Gibraltar, and then went along the African coast. Just a few miles, we could see the African coast. And I think it was 2 days before we landed in Naples. Late in the day, about 5 o'clock, you know, at sunset, all of a sudden, all the bells and whistles went off, and the destroyer went screaming off in a direction, and the ship came to a dead stop. And it turned, we had heard later that they picked up a submarine contact, German submarine. And I don't know whether they got it or not, but we sat there for about 3 or 4 hours while the destroyer was out there chasing this thing. And finally, we kind of snuck along the African coast and finally made it over to Italy. And we landed in Naples. And I remember my first impression of now I'm in the war was we tied up at a long pier in Naples, Italy, and the pier had a ship tied up at the pier that had been bombed by the Germans, had capsized on its side. Rather than move it, I guess they couldn't, they cut off all the superstructure on that side of the ship, and we tied up on the ship, and it had gangplanks that went across the hull and then down to the dock. You know, and that's it. And so when we were doing this, boy, you got to get hurt over here, you know.
Yeah.
And the ship had capsized right at the dock, and you walked across it to get to the dock.
Yeah, I think that would get my attention, too.
Yeah, it does, you know. Yeah.
And by this time, you were in a squadron, 527th Squadron of the 86th Fighter Bomber Group, flying P-47s.
Well, they had just transitioned. They had been flying the dive bomber version of the Mustang, the P-51.
Yeah.
Remember, it was called the A-36.
The A-36 Apache.
It had dive brakes. And they had just were transitioning into the P-47 when we got there. And then they picked us up at an airport near Naples and flew us over to Bastia in Corsica. And the 86 was there. This would have been late July. There was a whole row along the east coast of Corsica. There must have been 6 or 8 airfields, you know, side by side. And we're all getting ready for the invasion of southern France. And my very first mission was to, we tried to dive bomb a French battleship, the Richelieu, in Marseille Harbor. because they were worried about the Germans or the French might put it to sea and then, you know, entangle with the task force that was going to come in and invade southern France. So they wanted to put it out of action. And I didn't hit it. And I think there were eight of us. And I think two of them got close enough to where they might have damaged it somewhat. But the rest of it, I missed it. And I guess for maybe another month or two, we flew our missions into southern France. And you must know enough about the Air Force, and you would appreciate it. The pointy end of the spear in terms of the Air Force was strategic bombing or tactical bombing, you know. And the strategic Air Force, the 8th Air Force, was in England, and it had the long-range bombers and the long-range fighters, the Mustangs, after the P-47s. And then there was the 9th Air Force, which was a tactical air force, started out in England, and then when the invasion came, moved to France. And the tactical guys moved up with the front lines because their job was to support the ground advance, you know, shooting up trucks and trains and bridges and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And in Italy, we had the same situation. The Strategic Air Force was the 15th down at Foggia in southern Italy. And they ranged up into Germany and, you know, the Balkans. And they had 51s for the escort. But then the 12th Air Force, which was the one I was in, was the tactical air force. And our job was to support the advance up Italy. And then the invasion went so well, I remember the words were coming back that stop bombing the bridges anymore because we were actually slowing up the advance. Yeah. You know? So they put us, then moved us back over to Italy to Grosseto. It's on the west coast, about halfway up. And I was flying out of Grosseto when we were getting ready to move up again to Pisa, you know, where the Leaning Tower is.
Sure.
And I was in B Party. The A Party had already moved up, and the B Party was getting ready to move up, and we were still flying missions every day. And that's when I got hit and shot down.
And it's a wonder you survived that. We're going to hear all about it, but I want to hear more about your earlier missions, too, when we come back. 92-year-old Ray Maloney of Bonita Springs, Florida, is our guest. He doesn't sound 92, does he? When you hear what he survived, you'll be able to imagine why he might feel like he's been living on borrowed time for the last 7 decades. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, listening today to the story of Ray Maloney. I caught up with him in Bonita Springs, Florida, where I also had the pleasure of meeting his wife of 70 years, Cressida. You can see a picture of those two at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. They got married before Ray flew his first mission in a P-47 Thunderbolt. When we left off, Ray had mentioned being shot down while flying with the 86th Fighter Bomber Group, the 527th Squadron. That was on your 37th mission.
But I imagine there were some eventful moments on the first 36 of them. And that P-47, I've talked to several guys who flew them. And they all speak very fondly of that plane because they always say it could really take a beating. Did you prove that in those first 36 missions?
Yes, I did. Yeah, we got several times I got holes in airplanes, small ones, you know, bullet holes. But if I may, I can tell you the most frightening experience I had in the war, and it wasn't when I was shot down. It was when we were still on Corsica, and I think it was about my fourth or fifth mission, and we had taken off with 12 aircraft, and I was, they've got a red flight, a white flight, and a blue flight, four aircraft each. And I was in the blue flight, and I was tailing Charlie way over here. And if you remember Corsica, it was mostly mountains and just a little beach line along the east coast. And the leader of this squadron was a new guy to being a leader. So we started, made a 360 over the field, and then started to climb over the mountains. And he kept getting steeper and steeper and finally started to turn a little bit. And you remember in formation flying, the guys on the inside that turn are throttling back because right. They still have to want to stay with it. You know, this guy is making a bigger circle than the one down here is making a smaller circle.
Just like so, on a racetrack.
Yeah. It's exactly. See, so as when he kept climbing and climbing, we were getting slower and slower, and we had two 1,000-pound bombs and eight 50-caliber machine guns. If you remember the jug, the P-47, and loaded with ammo. So we were very heavy, and it was a hot day, and he climbs, gets steeper and steeper, and finally realized he wasn't going to clear the mountains in Corsica. And so he starts a steep right turn, and I'm way down here, you know. And just as he starts pulling it steeper and steeper, I'm almost back into nothing, you know, trying to stay with the formation, and I feel the airplane flutter. And if you know anything about flutter, that's the warning that you're going to stall.
Yeah.
You know, it's a flutter in your controls. You can feel it. And I, you know, scared, the hair went up my back, my neck, and I dove out of the formation. That was the only thing I could do. But we were so low, you know, squadron, the flight way back here, that as soon as I dove away to try to get some airspeed, I'm looking at the trees.
Uh-oh.
And I'm right on the top of the trees. And it was the most frightening experience that I had in all of my flying, because I thought, I'm not going to make it. I had all this weight and no airspeed. You know, I was right on stall.
Ooh.
And it just was frightening. Boy, I came out of that flight, you know.
Shaking a little, huh?
Yeah, it shook me. Yeah.
And you mentioned at one point, kept on flying every day. And that's one thing that's always struck me about the guys who flew missions like you, where you're dive bombing and skip bombing and strafing all these low altitude targets.
Yeah, right.
That you guys really were flying almost nonstop. I mean, it sounds kind of exhausting. How frequent were your missions?
Yeah, well, you know, you don't fly every, the squadron flies every day.
Yeah.
But you don't happen to be on the flight schedule every day unless things are really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd fly a mission and maybe another day or so before you'd be signed for a mission again. So a day or so between each mission, mm-hmm. I think. And again, the weather would come in. Sometimes, you know, you get bad weather, you couldn't fly at all. So the whole squadron, the whole group would be down.
Did you hear from your wife much while you were over there?
Yes, when I was, you know, before I got shut down, she was great. She'd write every day, you know, and put lipstick on the letter at the bottom. You know, this kind of stuff. We were kids, you know.
Yeah. What was your relationship like with the rest of the pilots in your squadron?
Fine. I had about four or five very good friends that I had, you know, gone through training with. When we went over to Italy and got signed to various groups, I ended up with two of my best friends, both Jewish fellows, too, good pilots. So I stayed with them in the 527th Fighter Squad. And the other two went to another group, 56th or one of the others, and so I lost track of them. But I heard later that both of them were killed. They were shot down.
Mm.
And one of them was my best friend, John Mosqua. And my son's middle name is John, and I made it. I named him after my friend John. And he was shooting up a freight train. And it blew up in front of them. You know, you never know what's in the train. It's a lot of times it's ammo.
Yeah.
You know, and it blew up in his face, and he was killed.
So, well, that was going to be my next question. How does that affect you? Here you are, a 22-year-old kid. Well, I guess you wouldn't turn 22 till you were a POW, but so you're, 21 years old over there flying these missions. you find out stuff like that is happening. Friends of yours die, and those are the same kind of missions you were flying. I mean, did it ever occur to you that could be you?
Yeah, of course. But I never, I've thought all the time, you know, I'm going to get killed or I might get killed. But I never thought about being a POW.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was kind of not one of the options.
It was A or B, and that wasn't
was
on
a
the sheet.
It was A or B.
Huh?
You survived. And of the two Jewish fellows that I ended up with, Paul Lefkow, he was shot down, and he was in Stalag Luft 1
Germany.
Yeah, in Germany.
Uh-huh.
And Al Leventhal was the only guy in my group that finished his tour, and I think he went to 111, 112 missions.
Wow.
And if I may, a little side issue, Al, the whole time I knew him when we were growing up, through flight training rather, he wanted to be a veterinarian. Mm-hmm. That was his ambitious. When he got out, he was going to go and train, become a vet. Well, he became a vet, you know, after the war, he finished his tour. But when I was shut down, you lose track of these people, you know. And 40 years later, I got a letter from a fellow in the squadron who was trying to generate a reunion.
Sure. Right?
And he had listed the people that he had made contact with him. One of them was Al Leventhal, and he was living in Bolton, Connecticut, and I was in Milford, Connecticut. You know? And so I called him up. You know, we had one of these reunions. Oh, where you been? You know, so we had a great time.
40 years later, you had your own two-man reunion?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, just before I went over, when I got married on the leave that we had just before we went overseas, so did Al. And he got married. And when we went into fighter training down in Georgia, he brought his bride down and I brought mine down. And there was one other couple who got married. And the three of us rented a cabin outside of the base down at Harris Neck, Georgia. There was two bedrooms and a couch. So the three newlyweds lived in it. And so every third night, you got the couch.
The rotation.
The rotation, right?
Oh, that's classic.
And that poor guy, he got killed too. Ward Worthington was his name. He bought it. But Al finished it all. And the bottom line of this, the reason I'm telling you this story is my daughter, the one who's here right now, lived with her husband up near Hartford in Vernon, Connecticut.
Yeah.
And so when I told her a story about Leventhal, she said, "What'd you say his name was?" I said, "Leventhal." She said, "We've been taking our dogs and cats to Al Leventhal for years and years, and they never made a connection."
How about that?
The name, you know, she...
That's classic.
Married. Yeah.
Wow. You never know with these stories, and it's only going to get more interesting as we discuss what happened to you in early November of 1944.
Okay.
Before that 37th mission, did it feel any different than any of those other missions? Did you have any kind of concern or inclination?
Now that, you know, I look back on it, I didn't really appreciate it or focus on it at the time, but I think you should start to wear down a little bit. You know, mm-hmm. you begin to think that maybe the odds are going to catch up with you. And so you become a little bit more cautious. You're not quite as reckless, as you are when you first start your combat. And I'm sure the guys, you know, felt the same thing. And, you know, I have to emphasize, the only heroes that I can see and that most of our guys are the ones that were killed. The rest of us, and everybody, I think, in combat, is scared skinny. You know, it's there. You know, you're facing it. And there's all these jokes about you strap yourself in this airplane and you push the throttle forward. And if you're not careful, it kills you. You know, and so we, you know, brush that off. And then at the end of the flight, we run to the bar, you know, and have a few drinks to try to calm yourself down. But it's there all the time. And as you're continuing your combat tour, it starts to wear at you a little bit. You know, you start worrying about, you know, I'm a third of the way through. Am I going to make it?
Especially when you brought that P-47 back with holes in the wings so many times.
Yeah, yeah. Well, not a lot. I think it was about three times there were a couple of holes in them. But we strafed, you know, a lot of times we'd attack a German convoy going down the road. And these guys all had guns, and so as you went over, they were all firing up at you and throwing their helmets and muskets up at you, you know, because you're right at treetop level.
Yeah.
And you're going like mad, but
What does that feel like physically when you make one of those runs, and especially if you're dive bombing? I have to imagine that the physical toll that takes on your body in those few seconds is pretty severe.
Yeah, you pull a few G's, but I think the bombing, as far as you know, getting hit during a bomb run, I don't. Yeah, because you wind up, the P-47 was so big and heavy that when you put that nose down and dive, it winds up like, you know, there's nothing could stay with it. And the word was always, if you get a 109 on your tail, head for the deck, because he's not going to be able to stay with you, you know. Mm-hmm. It winds up 400, 500, 600 miles an hour. And during the war, there were a number of occasions where fellows actually entered transonic. They almost went supersonic.
Yeah.
Paint would peel off the wings and things like this, you know, with a jug. And so being hit in a dive was really not a big worry, but it was when you were attacking people that could shoot back at you that, you know. And a lot of times there would be banks of, in fact, when I was shot down, it was a classic. It was a car with four banks of 20 millimeters, and each gun has four barrels. So you have 16 20 millimeters firing at you. And so long as you're, you know, going by, they have to lead you so much that rarely can they get you. But as soon as you turn around and start committing, you know, now you become a stable target. You're coming right at them, you know. And you can see these baseballs coming at you, you know, as you go down. But
you mean you had your eyes open?
yeah, you better. Because there's other guys doing it too, you know. You know, we don't want to collide with each other.
So you're in a dive, and this anti-aircraft artillery is coming,
it's coming
up at you.
Yeah.
And where did it hit your plane?
I don't know. It was in the fuel system somewhere, because I felt a bang, you know. And it took a few seconds as I peeled off and I saw some more of the baseballs, you know, coming back at you. Within a few seconds, I noticed my fuel pressure started to fluctuate. And then finally it started to zero, and I panicked. I didn't. And the P-47 has, for starting your engine, there's a little primer. Mm-hmm. You turn it into a little primer right on the instrument panel. And so the only thing I could think of, I uncorked it and started putting it, and I could bring the fuel pressure up, I could, you know, a little bit, so it kept the engine running while I primed, and I peeled off this thing and started making a turn south. And I told him, I said, I'm hit. And my wingman stayed with me, and I thought, well, maybe, and I got it up to, I think, about 7,000 or 8,000 feet, still pumping like mail at this thing.
Was your arm getting tired of pumping that little
primer? Yeah, I was frightened to death, you know. And my wingman said, you're smoking. It looks like you're on fire. He couldn't see fire, but he could see smoke coming out of me. So I said, yeah, I think I am on fire, because it was seemed to be getting warm in the cockpit. But I started to head south, and you got to cross the Apennine Mountains in Italy. I can't remember what the altitudes were. Probably maybe 8,000 on down, you know.
Sure.
And again, without power, the P-47 is so heavy, it's only going one way when you don't have power, and that's down. And so I couldn't hold altitude. I kept falling down. And finally, I got to a point where I had a kind of a hill, a mountain in front of me, and I knew I couldn't clear that, so I turned this way and headed down, and now I'm down in a valley. And it's amazing. I've thought through many times since then about how I ever managed to go through this thinking process that probably took a split second. Because as soon as I looked at this valley, I knew there was no place I could put this airplane. So I had to get out of it, mm-hmm. you know. And just like that, I just unhooked everything, climbed out the left side, and kicked out. And I saw the airplane still smoking, and I saw it one quick thing, and I looked back, and bam, it was that quick. And since then, I've tried to, in my mind, because people have a lot say, how high were you? I don't know how high I was, but it was in this valley, and I was heading down into the valley. And I, in my mind's eye, when I've tried to recreate those few seconds, and I think it was about no more than 5 seconds, maybe 4 seconds before I hit the ground. And my chute, I never got that jerk, you know, that you're supposed to get. The good Lord, I think, was watching over me that day. And my wingman, I found out much later, years later, he reported that he said, "I don't think he made it." He said, "I didn't see that chute really blossom. It streamed out." And I hit right on my heels and my rear end. And it went, bah, you know, I could feel it. It was a terrible pain. Terrible pain.
Yeah, I can only imagine what that felt like. And it's hard to imagine that you actually survived that. I have a few questions to follow up on it, but we need to take another commercial break here. When we come back, some of what Ray Maloney went through after being shot down in his P-47 and bailing out at very low altitude over German-held territory. Hometown Heroes is coming right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, hearing from 92-year-old World War II fighter pilot and ex-prisoner of war, Ray Maloney. He lives in Connecticut part of the year, Florida the rest. He's originally from New York. But on November 5th, 1944, a week before his 22nd birthday, Ray's P-47 was shot up by German anti-aircraft guns. He tried to keep the sputtering plane flying, but realized that wasn't going to happen, and he bailed out just seconds before it went down. A couple questions to follow up on what you shared before the break. Two things, Ray.
A, your chute never opened, but yet you survived.
Partially.
Or never fully opened, yet you survived. Maybe that is miraculous.
Yeah.
B, had you waited one more second?
Yeah, I wouldn't have had any room to bail out. I would have had to try to crash into the side of the... There was no place down there that was flat.
1 second, you know? And you would have been gone. Well, never would have seen your wife again. Three kids, 9 grandkids, 5 great-grandkids. Wouldn't be here.
Yeah, I didn't think about those at the moment. But
Yikes.
Yeah, I think... And I've since... Not because of that episode, but now that I'm old and closer to my maker, I've gotten religion and I now go to church every Sunday trying to make amends.
So you hit the ground and you mentioned your heels and your rear end. How long was it till you started feeling some pretty severe pain?
Oh, immediately. Right away. I couldn't stand up. It was that painful. I was on my hands and knees. And the Germans, they sent a patrol up, 6 or 7 men, and I could tell that they were looking for me. You know, they were pointing and talking. There's part of it I don't want to talk about, but within about 10 minutes or so, I was out of ammunition, and one guy said, "Stand up," in English, and I tried to stand up, and I closed my eyes. I thought, I'm going to get killed right now, and the only German words I could think of was kaput. You know, and I said, "Kaput, kaput." And so they came over and they recognized that I was on my hands and knees. I could barely move. And so it still was very painful, but they took 2 rifles and I sat on the 2 rifles and put my arms around these 2 Germans. And they carried me maybe 400 or 500 yards to some little dugout where they had, were spending the night. They had a little straw in a little tiny roof thing there, and I spent the night there. And then the next day, took me down to some little medical facility that Germans had. And I spent, I think, 2 days there. And they put a big piece of canvas from groin to up under my arms to try to support my back. And I started my sojourn up to Germany.
I'm sure everyone listening right now is in the same boat as I am, thinking, how in the world would I feel in that situation? What would be going through my mind? So you're on your hands and knees, you can't stand up, and I don't want to prod you to talk about things you're not comfortable with, but clearly you're trying to defend yourself in the situation you're in with a 45, I suppose, that you had.
Yeah, I fired it, yeah.
And then you're going to be captured. You already told us you never considered being a POW. It was, I'm going to finish my missions or I'm going to die.
Yeah, right.
So now here you are, 21 years old, in that situation. How scared were you?
I was scared skinny. Yeah, you know, you do what you're trained to do, but when you're facing, you know, your maker, I don't know, you probably are not thinking properly anyway. But
and I imagine there was no assurance for you that these Germans capturing you are going to treat you right.
Oh, no, you know, you're in the land of the unknown now. It could happen any time, yeah.
Yet they did
but
give you medical attention.
The military, yeah. I think if when you're in the hands of the Germans, certainly, you're better off with the military. You're safer. In fact, when I was brought up into Germany, we were traveling on train for a while, and we got into Munich it was evening time. It was dark. I guess it was the 15th Air Force that just finished bombing Munich, and part of it was the railroad yards
right
in Munich. And our train had to wait outside for an hour or so to go in. And then we had to change trains in Frankfurt. And there was one other South African pilot with me that they brought us up together, and two guards. And the two guards told me, take the wings off, because we'll be going through the station in Munich. And 15th, they just bombed the hell out of it.
So those civilians are going to be pretty angry.
So they were protecting me by taking my wings off. They said, if the civilians see you, they'll kill you. You know.
So those guys didn't need to tell you that. That's pretty humane of them to do so.
Yeah, but you know how you can't blame the Germans either. We were killing them by the thousands, and it's wartime, and that's the name of the game.
I mentioned you were shot down a week shy of your 22nd birthday. How'd you spend that birthday? I imagine that birthday is pretty unique among the 92 that you've had.
Yeah, I was in, I said the basement, but I was in the basement for a while in a house in Verona, and then they moved to the second floor, and the day of my birthday was on the second floor, locked in a room all by myself, and I was hanging out the window looking at the downspout, the rain downspout, and I was trying to decide whether it was strong enough to try to go down that. There was another drain that you know fed into that drain, and I felt at it, and it was kind of loose. And I thought, if I grab that thing, I'll probably end up, you know, two floors down on the ground. And so I didn't do it, but I was standing there entertaining the idea if I could climb down that drain spout, I might be able to get out of here. But I didn't do it because I didn't think the thing would hold me.
You were plotting your own great escape, huh?
Yeah, right. It was on my birthday.
And I'm sure, again, people can empathize and understand how your mind has to go in a million different directions when you're in a situation like this. So much uncertainty. And you mentioned them transporting you. I'm sure eventually you were interrogated.
Oh, yeah.
The Dulag Luft.
The Dulag, yeah.
The infamous interrogation center. Yeah, yeah. So when they brought you in, what did they say to you? How did that conversation unfold?
Well, we hadn't eaten when we departed from Italy. They gave us a little package of some sandwiches and hard bread, you know, and stuff, and sausage. And they didn't tell us how long this would have to last. And so Stan, South African fellow's name with me, Stan Gray, that was his name. We figured it was a one-day supply of food, and the next day we get another. Well, we ate that one day, and we were now into the third day without any food. So by the time we got to the Dulag, it was late at night, and we hadn't had anything to eat for going on 2 days. It wasn't quite 2 days. And so we said, you know, we're hungry. And they said, well, the kitchen is closed tomorrow. So Stan went one way, and I was sent another way, and that was the last I ever saw Stan. But you end up in this little 8x4 foot cubicle with a little tiny bunk in it. There was a thing on the doorway that you turned, and one way it had a red cross for medical, if you had medical problems. And so I went to sleep on the bunk, and in the morning I turned this thing, and I was there for 10 days, and nobody ever came to see me with the back. And there'd be a knock at the door, and the door would open, and the guy would hand you a piece of brown bread cut very thin with a kind of a swipe of jelly on it, or jam, rather, and then a little cup of coffee. ersatz coffee, fake coffee. I don't know what they were making it out of. And so, you know, I'm waiting for the eggs and bacon, and that was it.
It wasn't coming.
It wasn't coming, you know. And so, and then in the evening, you got two meals. In the evening, you got a little bit of sausage and a little thicker piece of bread, and again, another little tiny half cup of this awful coffee. And that was all you had. And so for 10 days, you get that once a day, you know, in the morning and at night.
In a 4-foot by 8-foot room, and I'm sure people are thinking 4 feet by 8 feet. Mm. That's tiny. You can barely stretch your arms
out.
Tiny,
yeah, it's small in this room, yeah. Yeah,
it's for 10 days, that's got to be a long 10 days.
Oh, I tell you, and there's no windows, you know, there's nothing. And there were probably dozens, hundreds of these rooms. I don't know how many. But and they let you cool your heels for a week or so until you're dying to talk to somebody, you know, something. And then they take you out. And I was questioned with some officer. He knew what group I was from. He knew what squadron I was from. And he had a book with lists of missions and stuff, photographs. I was absolutely shocked. And he showed me a picture of four pilots, and I was one of them, yeah. And he knew there was something about that mission, and he wanted to know what that mission was. Well, as soon as I saw the four guys, I knew what it was. The mission had flown its 2,000th sortie, and that night we had a little party about it. And but, you know, I told him, I said, I don't know, I flew bunch of missions. I don't know what one you're talking about and everything.
So this had been a news clipping that they had added to their collection of intel.
Yeah, it had these four. Not a news clipping. It was a photograph, you know, a little photograph. I don't know where the hell it came from, but there's I was in it. There was four guys, and there I am standing there in a flight gear still, you know, like we had just come back.
So a photo taken on your base that wasn't published anywhere
that
he still found.
That he had on that book. Yeah.
Tells you how good their intelligence network was, huh?
Yeah, oh, it was amazing.
I've had a lot of POWs tell me that the air interrogators knew more about them than they knew themselves.
That's right.
It sounds like you're saying the same thing.
Yeah, right.
And as far as your physical condition at this point, were you starting to heal up? Were you still in a lot of pain?
I was in pain. It was slowly subsiding, but I was in, you know, I had ache pain. I couldn't stand more than a few minutes, you know. Walking was terrible. It was painful to sit down. You just can't escape it. It's with you, you know.
What gave you hope in that situation? Because I'm sure you had to have some hope to keep going.
Yeah, well, you know, it sounds kind of fluky, but you have to kind of come to grips with yourself, you know, what you're faced with now. And I kind of knew where we were in the war, and, you know, I knew we were winning. And I told myself, well, I'll give it 6 months, you know. And at the end of the 6 months, if nothing's happened, then I'm going to have to do something. You know, I thought, well, I'll wait 6 months. And if I'm still here, I'm going to have to then actively pursue something to get out of here, you know, escape or something. And it happened almost exactly 6 months to where, you know, the war ended.
Yes, the war ended, but there were a lot of things that happened in those 6 months that we really need to explore. So this is going to be one of those rare situations where we stretch an interview over to a second episode of Hometown Heroes. We're going to hear Ray explain what life in a prisoner of war camp was really like, how glorious it was to experience freedom again after living without it for a while, and a couple adventures he's had in the years since that I think you're going to enjoy hearing about as well. I'll look forward to sharing that with you next time, but we're out of time on Hometown Heroes for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.